From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. In this week's episode, the focus is regional cooperation in Asia. Specifically, we're talking about China's famous One Belt, One Road initiative that aims to revive some of the networks and connections of the old Silk Road that connected East Asia to Europe and beyond. At the same time, South Korea put out its vision for the region through their Eurasia initiative, a similarly ambitious plan to create connections as far away as sub-Saharan Africa. To dig into these projects, some of the similarities and differences, I sat down with Dr. Balbina Huang, a visiting professor at Georgetown, who recently wrote a paper for KEI called A Fork in the Road, Korea and China's One Belt, One Road Initiative. Dr. Huang, thank you so much for joining me here on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
So can you start us off and give us a little bit of an introduction to One Belt, One Road? How did it come about and what is the purpose?
Certainly. So, One Belt, One Road is a very catchy phrase that has been articulated by President Xi Jinping, which he did quite early in his tenure as leader of China, back in March of 2013. Now, in reality, of course, this is not exactly when it was launched, because in fact, One Belt, One Road encompasses perhaps China's grandest project, most ambitious project, perhaps to date in its entire civilization, but certainly in its modern era. And if successful, could end up changing certainly not just the role of China and its power and the region, but actually the entire balance of global power. Now, what exactly is One Belt, One Road? Well, it's a classically poetic Chinese name for essentially reviving what is called the Ancient Silk Road. I'm sure most of your listeners are quite familiar with. This is the famous roads that essentially began globalization several centuries ago, and of course made famous by Marco Polo's travels connecting the Western world with the Eastern world. And most of this physical connection, the actual Silk Road, was essentially cut off in the 20th century due to world wars, but also obviously due to the Cold War. So it was really after the end of the Cold War, but also the opening of China, that enabled this incredibly rich region of Central Asia, which had been neglected for a century, to once again become the focus of great power rivalry. And in fact, I think that's exactly what we are seeing today. We are seeing a revival of what has traditionally been called the Great Game, where you have all of the global powers, the Western powers represented by the key anchors in Europe, the United Kingdom, even Germany, France, and certainly Russia, and of course China. Now, the United States, because of its interest, strategic and security interest in Afghanistan, is also interested, but frankly is a side player in this great game. So China's One Belt, One Road is really the manifestation of a long-term project that has already been underway, and essentially it is the first strategic articulation of China's new vision for its place in the region and for essentially being the economic and political driver of a much, much broader region that encompasses everything from Western Europe all the way to the Far East.
So around the same time, interestingly, President Park Geun-hye in South Korea announced the Eurasia Initiative, which is kind of similar but has some differences, of course. So how does this policy fit in or sometimes clash with One Belt, One Road?
Yes, exactly. So this has been the most interesting aspect. Now, speaking about this great game that is going on, meaning all these great powers are involved and very, very interested in this incredibly strategic geographical region of Central Asia, which is the geographical link that physically links Western Europe and the Far East, you had Xi Jinping's, again, formal articulation of this policy in March of 2013 and then later in October 2013, where he basically combined the two parts of One Belt, One Road. One is the Silk Economic Belt, And one is the Maritime Road. So that is essentially the One Belt, One Road. Now, interestingly, President Park of South Korea, in October of 2013, the same year, announces her own initiative called the Eurasia Initiative. And her initiative is actually part of her grand vision for the region, but also South Korea's role, in what she called the Era of Eurasia. And interestingly, she also talked about reviving the ancient Silk Road. And her manifestation of this Eurasia Initiative specifically includes linking what's called the Silk Road Express. So linking roads and actually train transportation, meaning land transportation. And she presented this vision of you would board a train in London, sort of reviving the nostalgia of the Orient Express, and travel not just to Venice, but even further east, all the way through Turkey, Central Asia. And ultimately, you would end up not on the east coast of China, but actually on the Korean Peninsula of South Korea in Busan, which technically speaking, is even further east of China's vision of the One Belt, One Road. So in some ways, tiny South Korea, relative to China's vision, is actually even more ambitious, frankly, than China. Although China's One Belt, One Road is probably the grandest project ever articulated by any state in history, because it encompasses some $9 billion, and some say in the future, maybe even trillions of dollars worth of investments.
So to get a little bit more specific, what exactly is China doing to create this One Belt, One Road? What kind of projects are they investing in, and that kind of thing?
Again, it's important to remember that One Belt, One Road did not get started in 2013 when Xi Jinping articulates under this umbrella called One Belt, One Road. In fact, it is actually a manifestation of what China has already been doing at least for the last decade. And so this all stems from China's grand development project, first beginning with its grand domestic development and modernization plan to essentially ensure that China's growth, this incredible, miraculous industrialization and modernization project within China, is not just sequestered to the regional areas, which of course contributes to unequal development, but actually to the vast hinterlands of China, which are largely uninhabited but also undeveloped. And so at least for the last decade, China has spent billions of dollars connecting all of the vast regions within the Chinese territory, connecting them through networks, not just physical lands and railroads, but also networks, meaning communication networks. And now that China is essentially comfortable connecting its industrialized, sophisticated, modern Eastern economies with its much more rural, undeveloped Western regions, it is now looking to expand that similar type of successful development beyond its borders. So again, the articulation is really a manifestation of a long-term project that China has already been working on. My specific argument about looking at China's One Belt, One Road is that it is obviously an incredibly ambitious economic project with political implications, but it's also part of China's essentially national grand strategy, which is to ensure regional exterritorial stability. What this means is that for China, economic modernization, it is believed, leads to domestic stability, which then will also, perhaps directly, perhaps indirectly, lead to political stability. But the key is for China that in its regional neighbors, China must ensure that there is stability economically, and most importantly, also socially, because this has direct impact on China's communist leadership and its ambitions to maintain its control over China for the coming decades.
It's important to emphasize that South Korea is not technically part of One Belt, One Road, right?
No, it is not technically part of One Belt, One Road. Now, one of the difficulties and one of the main criticisms of One Belt, One Road is that the Chinese government has not been able to articulate very clearly, or perhaps willingly, it purposely has not, but it encompasses such a vast region. It includes ultimately some 60 countries. There are specifically six primary corridors both land corridors and maritime corridors. Your listeners can consult the written paper and look at all the details about these. But they are multi-directional and geographic, and they target specific areas for China to connect with a geographically strategic land and maritime access. Now, interestingly, if you look at these access points, all linking this One Belt, One Road, from China's perspective, it all looks north and west and south. The one geographic area that One Belt, One Road completely ignores is directly to China's east. Now, if you look on a map, you say, well, there's not much to China's east. There's the vast Pacific Ocean. But in fact, it's actually crucial because technically the very small peninsular outcropping off the Asian mainland is the Korean Peninsula. And the Korean Peninsula, as tiny as it is relative to the vast Asian landmass, has over the centuries, for thousands of years actually, been absolutely the single most crucial geographical real estate in the entire region. It has over the centuries been absolutely the pivot for all the major wars and actually for civilizations both rising and waning. So what is very, very starkly interesting about One Belt, One Road is currently it seems to completely ignore anything to the east, essentially saying the Korean Peninsula. I do not believe that is accidental. And I think the reason that it is left off the table in terms of public articulation is frankly because of the role of North Korea. In fact, all of this ends up coming back to North Korea, which is interesting because North Korea is the one most passive player and is going against all the trends in the region, which is to try to connect and try to seek outward expansion or at least outward relationships. North Korea is the only one that says to everybody else, go away, we want to remain closed. But the reality is that North Korea is absolutely the key because currently it occupies literally the geographic access for South Korea, which essentially is a geographic island because of North Korea's existence, and frankly, China's physical geographic access to the rest of the Pacific Ocean. In fact, for example, Japan is really the only way you access Japan is through the Korean Peninsula. Now, obviously, in today's modern economies, you just ignore sort of the fact that North Korea is geographically obstructionist, because obviously we have ships, we have planes, and we have other types of connections that can just skirt around North Korea. But the reality is that geography still matters, even in our modern era, and it will continue to matter. And I think China, for the time being, has chosen to essentially ignore its view physically to the east, just because North Korea is so problematic in terms of throwing a wrench into China's grand plan to essentially unify or at least connect the entire region. But for South Korea, North Korea is absolutely the key. And part of Park Geun-hye's ambition, I believe, with her Eurasia initiative, is not just connecting South Korea or the Korean Peninsula with the West, not just ensuring that South Korea's continued economic growth and modernization is interconnected with the growth and modernization of the Western world, but in fact that it was her way of trying to integrate North Korea into her vision for a peaceful region. So again, the contrast between One Belt, One Road vision and Park Geun-hye's Eurasia initiative is that One Belt, One Road was very much focused on economic stability, economic progress, economic modernization. I believe the unarticulated but real purpose is also to ensure social stability in China's neighbors, and then ultimately political stability. But for Park Geun-hye, it was very much about starting off with a vision for the entire region, which she emphasized would be peaceful, a region of coexistence and peace. So she was emphasizing the security aspects. Meanwhile, playing on all of South Korea's economic advantages and all of the tangible material and economic benefits that come from this type of integration, and also addressing some of South Korea's needs, for example, energy resources. But in the end, North Korea holds the key. And I think early in 2013, she really did believe that this kind of initiative would be the anchor upon which she could place her trust politique towards North Korea, where it was a more nuanced policy towards North Korea to try to coax North Korea into a more cooperative relationship with South Korea. And I think North Korean actions since then, in 2014, in 2015, certainly the beginning of 2016, it is very clear that North Korea is not interested. And it has essentially shut the door. It has actually slammed the door on Park Geun-hye's initiatives and, frankly, also China's. And now, of course, with President Park's own domestic problems, unfortunately, I think this has been pushed to the wayside. And in fact, the Eurasia Initiative has actually significantly shifted, both in terms of the way it's going to be pursued and implemented, practically speaking, because it's no longer now about integrating a region. It's really about using it as a tool to try to pressure North Korea.
So I'm glad you mentioned this, because there is that caveat or elephant in the room of the domestic situation in South Korea taking precedence for now. So, you know, keeping that in mind, but is there a way to marry these things? Is there a way for South Korea to move forward despite North Korea? Is there a way to bring some of these initiatives together? Or is that even the right way to move forward with regional integration?
Well, I think two things. The first thing is, no, in the end, a pipe dream, and I use that term facetiously, because one of the plans is to build a pipeline, right, from Russia to the southern half of the Korean Peninsula as a way to transfer energy. And the problem is that pipe has to go through North Korea. So it is literally an impossible dream. And so figuratively, it's an ambitious plan. It's great. But no, the point is that ultimately North Korea holds the geographical key. And if North Korea continues to remain shut and closed and remains to be the recalcitrant actor, then South Korea will continue to be a geographical island. Now, obviously, that has not inhibited South Korea from modernizing and developing. But that geographic lock, if you will, is really the key to the future of stability on the Korean Peninsula. Because ultimately, what this means is that it is all dependent on the future of the North Korean regime. And unless that issue is ever settled, and we don't know if we're talking about unification, reunification, a collapse of North Korea, some sort of a, you know, separate two-state system. The point is that we remain in this very uncertain term. So that's true, I think, essentially perpetually until something changes in North Korea.
So from what I understand, you're also interested in how South Korea is trying to reach out to countries outside of Asia, and particularly those who have in the past been somewhat close to North Korea, for example, Iran, Uganda, those kinds of countries, which is kind of a part of the Eurasian Initiative, this more ambitious outside of Asia goal. So how is Korea working outside of the Asia Pacific to achieve some of its more security related goals?
Well, I think we have to understand this actually in the context. First of all, this specific, and it's a very specific tactical shift of President Park, that's actually very recent. That is something that comes after, but what's important is what came before. We have to understand that South Korea's Eurasia Initiative, first of all, Eurasia Initiative by Park Geun-hye, it was not new. It's actually built on what her predecessors have been thinking about and actually laying the groundwork for quite a long time. Going as far back as Kim Yong-sam in the 1990s, he started off with a globalization or Segyewa policy. And that was right after the end of the Cold War, when the entire global environment was in flux. So in some ways, it was actually quite a visionary idea. South Korea struggled with this and didn't necessarily implement it. But as we fast forwarded two decades, President Lee Myung-bak, President Park's predecessor, was actually quite successful in launching and implementing his Global Korea Project. And in fact, I think 5 years under his tenure, South Korea now is a global brand. So I think he deserves a lot of credit. So this Eurasia Initiative is actually not particularly new or anything grandly innovative in that regard. It builds on very much South Korea's progression. Having said that, it's even more important to understand that this is also not occurring in a vacuum. In other words, this is why the linkage to China's One Belt, One Road is so important. And China's One Belt, One Road is also not occurring in a vacuum. As I mentioned in the beginning, there is a great game afoot in this region of Central Asia. And it's because Central Asia, very much like the Korean Peninsula, occupies a very important strategic geographic foothold that links the West and the East as it has for centuries. And the similarities are very striking. Just as the Korean Peninsula has for so long been coveted by great powers, great empires that surround it for centuries, not for any intrinsic value on the Korean Peninsula, but purely for its geographic strategic value, it is the same with Central Asia. So you have many countries of Central Asia, quite young republics, many of them struggling economically, struggling socially and politically, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and so on. And these countries understand that they are very much share the Korean Peninsula's historic experience of being the strategic pivot. So they understand that they are now the targets of all of these great powers in the West and in the East that are sort of eyeing it and understanding that their influence and control over their countries and their region is crucial to expanding all of the powers. In addition to China's One Belt, One Road and South Korea's Eurasia Initiative, we actually have Russia's Eastern Dream. India has an Act East policy. Japan is pursuing its own policy that it is typically labeled in a rather awkward title, but Free and Open Indo-Pacific Strategy. And frankly, even the United States pivot to Asia. So as all of these great powers have their own strategies about increasing their influence in the region, but also using the region as a connection point for their own countries to their neighboring regions, South Korea has also following the same example. So interestingly, as I mentioned, Russia, India, Japan, and obviously China, all of these countries are looking at all of the sort of satellite or peripheral countries that are just outside the geographic region that links East and West. So Japan, India, Russia, and especially China are going to all of these regions in Africa, in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe, and trying to target these countries and bring them in into essentially their vision or their ambition of creating this kind of network. So South Korea, I believe, has started off that way. But again, President Park was not doing anything new. I mean, Lee Myung-bak actually had these very strong initiatives. He had one targeted towards South Asia, as well as Central Asia, and then one in Southeast Asia. So that was really South Korea's attempt to venture outside of its immediate neighborhood, into its so-called backyard, instead of just developing relationships with Western Europe and with the United States. So I think that's where South Korea started in 2013. But again, North Korean actions since then, under Kim Jong-un's leadership in 2013, 2014, and especially 2015, I think actually switched President Park's determination. I think it became clear to her that, frankly, the Eurasia Initiative, again, because of this geographical blockade, was essentially just a dream or a fantasy and could never be resolved until you resolve the issue of what to do with North Korea. So that essentially became the focus. So President Park then was going not just to Africa, in the Middle East, into South Asia and Southeast Asia, not just to talk to these partners to continue to develop economic and political ties and social ties as part of this broader vision to create a greater integrated network, but then specifically with the very, very narrow purpose of trying to use South Korea's diplomatic leverage, actually, against North Korea. And so this is a case of where events sort of overtook actual strategies. And I think in many ways, I wouldn't say President Park lost her strategic vision, but I think the more immediate pressing security concerns of North Korea's, specifically North Korea's WMD programs, ended up taking over the agenda. And so it made sense for her when she was visiting Burma, for example, or Indonesia or other countries that have had friendlier or long-term relationships with North Korea to actually use that leverage to bring these countries onto the side of, well, not just South Korea, but the United States, Japan, and others in the international community and essentially within the arena of the United Nations to put more pressure on North Korea.
All right. So this is a huge vision that we'll have to be following as things progress. So I want to thank you very much for coming to KEI, presenting your paper here a few weeks ago. And you can check out that paper online. It's on our website, www.keia.org. So thank you so much for all your time and your insights.
Thank you very much for KEI's interest in this project. I think it's a tremendously important project, and it's very important to continue the kind of research into it. So it's wonderful that KEI has been supporting this sort of research.
Let me just say thank you once again for joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Please like and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you here again next week.